We've been going through the book of Exodus, and this actually is probably one of the toughest chapters for us as 21st century Western Christians to process. It's a challenging text, but I want you to think about something for just a moment as we're heading into looking at the text. You know, when I was 15, I got my license younger than most people because we had a hardship. We owned a lot of businesses. And so that meant that my folks needed me to be able to drive. And so I got my license way too early. Let me just say that. And so I became quite, acquainted with the law over the issues of driving. And, you know, I found out something at 15 years of age that everybody ought to know, but most people don't know. Did you know that ignorance of the law is not a defense? So if you look at the officer and you say something like to the effect of, 40? Are you kidding me? No. It couldn't possibly just be 40 miles an hour through here. I know there's a school and all, but, you know, I didn't know it was just 40 miles an hour. Or maybe you've said something like, I don't know, officer, I didn't know it was a school zone. That's not a defense. Just as like it's not a defense when the guy says something like, well, I didn't know she was only 16. She looked 20 to me. That's not a defense. It's not a defense. Ignorance is not a defense in the case of the law. In fact, here's the deal. Now, I think this is part of it. I'm not sure that this is all of it, but I think this might be part of it, is the simple fact that, you know, if ignorance was a defense, we wouldn't have any need for lawyers, right? Because what do everybody say? Oh, I'm sorry, Oh, that would be convenient, wouldn't it? But the thing is the law doesn't work like that. The reality is that in society, we expect people to learn the laws of the land. And one of the things that I find intriguing is whether you're talking about a free society or a dictatorial society, whatever society you look at, wherever there is rule of law, whether they appreciate that rule of law or not, here's the deal. Ignorance is never a defense. Not in any land, not in any place, except in the minds of 21st century Western people where we go, I shouldn't be guilty. I didn't know. But in reality, all around the world, everybody in the world understands that the truth is that ignorance of the law is not a defense. It is not our way, because we have a common understanding of what is good and right in the world. And I don't care what culture you go to, what people group you go to, there are things that are always wrong, and there are things that are always understood as right. It doesn't matter where you go. Those things are true. And so when you look at those whole things of society, here's what we know is that where people are being responsible and are acquainting themselves with the law, people live happy, much more happy lives, live a greater sense of fulfillment. And where people live in spite of those laws, live in contradiction to those laws, they find themselves in a lot of pain. So today, we're in Exodus chapter 12, dealing with the failures of Pharaoh and the consequences of justice that have fallen upon the land of Egypt. Now, in our text, we're going to see the hand of God's judgment come upon not only Egypt, but also the potential of it coming upon Israel, and the price that is paid by everyone, but those who seek refuge and protection under the blood of the Lamb find themselves rescued, not because they're deserving, but absolutely in spite of that. They find themselves rescued simply because God is good. Let's take a look. Exodus chapter 12. I'm going to read in the first 13 verses, and I'm going to jump down to verse 29 and read through verse 40, simply because if I read all 55 verses, that would be our sermon this morning. And so I'm going to trust that you will finish reading in the pieces that we don't cover, but I think you'll get the greater context. Verse 1, "And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, 'This month shall be for you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year for you. So tell all the congregation of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, every man shall take a lamb according to their father's house, a lamb for a household. And if the household is too small for a lamb, then he and his nearest neighbor shall take according to the number of persons, according to what each can eat, you shall make your count for the lamb. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male, a year old, and you'll take it from the sheep or from the goats. And it shall be kept until the 14th day of the month, when the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill their lambs at twilight. Then they shall take some of the blood and put it on the doorpost of the lintel of the house in which they eat. And they shall eat that flesh that night, roasted on the fire with unleavened bread and bitter herbs they shall eat it. Do not eat of it raw or boiled in water, but roasted, its head and its legs and its inner parts, and you shall let none of it remain until morning. Anything that remains until the morning you shall burn, for in this manner you shall eat of it, with your belt fastened, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. And you shall eat it in haste, for it is the Lord's Passover. For I will pass through the land of Egypt that night, and I will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and on all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. The blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and no plague will befall you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. Jumping down to verse 29. And at midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh, who sat on his throne, to the firstborn of the captive, who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of the livestock. And Pharaoh rose up in the night, and he and all of his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where someone was not dead. Then he summoned Moses and Aaron by night and said, "Up, go out from among my people, both you and the people of Israel, and go and serve the Lord as you have said. Take your flocks and your herds as you have said, and be gone, and bless me also." The Egyptians were urgent with the people to send them out of the land in haste, for they said, "We shall all be dead." So the people took their dough before it was leavened, their kneading bowls being bound up in their cloaks on their shoulders, and the people of Israel had done as Moses had told them, for he said for them to ask the Egyptians for silver and gold jewelry and for clothing, and the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they let them have whatever they asked, and they plundered the Egyptians. And the people of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children. A mixed multitude also went up with them, and very much livestock, both flocks and herds. And they baked the unleavened bread cakes of the dough that they had brought out of Egypt, for it was not leavened, because they were thrust out of Egypt and could not wait, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves. And at the time the people of Israel lived in Egypt was about 430 years. And at the end of the 430 years, on that very day, all the host of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. It was a night of watching by the Lord to bring them out of the land of Egypt. So this same night is a night of watching kept to the Lord by all the people of Israel throughout their generations. And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "This is the statue of Passover. No foreigner shall eat of it, but every slave that is bought for money may eat of it, that you have circumcised him. No foreigner or hired hand may eat of it. It shall be eaten in one house, and you shall not take any of the flesh outside of the house, and you shall not break any of its bones. And all the congregation of Israel shall keep it. And if a stranger shall sojourn with you and would keep the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised. Then he may come near and keep it, and he shall be as a native of the land. But no uncircumcised person shall eat of it. There shall be one law for the native and for the stranger who sojourns among you." And all the people of Israel did just as the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron. And on that very day, the Lord brought the people of Israel up out of the land of Egypt by their hosts. Well, like I said, this is kind of a difficult passage. It's not one of those passages that you go, "Woohoo! You know, I can't wait to talk about that one." It's interesting in the text here that the word that we taught that is translated Passover in our Bibles is actually a Hebrew word, Pasah. And we translate it Passover, but actually there's something unique about this word, and the connotation of Passover is there, but literally it's translated as "he defends." In other words, the idea of Pesah is not passing over in the sense of just going by, but it's passing over in the sense of that because there's something in the way defending. It is at best understood in this idea of intercession, of standing in the gap, of being in the way so that no harm can come to. And one of the things, whenever it's talking about this, it's being really clear that it is the angel of death is the one who does the passing over, Because the Lord himself is the one who is defending at the door. In other words, in simple, it's like this, that the angel of death doesn't pass over any door. He comes to every door, and every door where there is blood, the Lord is waiting there, and God takes the hit of death so that they don't fall under a judgment they justly deserve. Oh, wait a minute. Weren't we talking about Israel? The people of God, who are distinctly different. But why are they distinctly different? It's a really important distinction here because, see, the thing is that a lot of times when we look at this whole context and we think, in our 21st century mindset, gosh, it doesn't seem very fair that Egypt would be suffering like this and because of one man, one king, being difficult, and there's this whole thing of God's honor involved, and I don't understand these things. How could it be just that God would wipe these people out and bring this judgment of death upon the land of Egypt when they didn't know the Lord? Ignorance of the law is no defense. Ignorance of the law is no defense. It's funny. Now, when we do it in land, in country after country after country, we think that that sounds normal and reasonable, and we can even reason out why it's that way. But it's funny, when we get to the things of God, somehow we feel like that there is a responsibility on the part of God that he has to come and hold us by the hand and convince us of everything. But what's interesting is that God really did do that when he was dealing with Egypt all through every test and trial that came their way. It's kind of interesting how we tend to look at this a little differently because our tendency is really to see it through the eyes of Egypt. And why wouldn't we? Let's think of it this way. Israel has been in captivity for 430 years in Israel. But one of the things that's interesting is you look at the captivity of Israel is that we see things where, like, for instance, Aaron goes out to meet his brother Moses unmolested. How does a slave get to go make a journey out in the wilderness to meet his brother? You see, their concept of slavery and our concept of slavery are quite a bit different because we have different histories. But in their context, we're talking about bond servants and people who living in a land under authority in a way that's completely foreign to our understanding of this whole thing. And the reality is that, yes, their oppression is great, but the people of Israel have gotten used to their bondage. Nobody has to tell them they can't run away. They know that they're not going to run away. And they're even able to travel. It's a little different than what we tend to think of. And Israel, in the midst of 430 years, honestly, is not that different than Egypt. They know that they're the covenant people of God, and they get circumcised on the eighth day and things like that, but there's really not a great understanding of what it means to be the people of God or what it means to belong to God or who God is. And so they're learning those lessons. We've been talking about this in Exodus. They're learning the same lessons that the Egyptians are learning in that moment. They're seeing revelation of God because the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, are being written at this moment. They don't have a Bible. They haven't been able to be taught all these things. And so they're finding out really who the great I am is, the same time the Egyptians are learning who the great I am is. They're all learning these lessons together, but there will be two distinctly different responses in the midst of it. But the reality is that we look at Israel, and if we were to sneak peek ahead, just a little bit ahead, and watch how Israel behaves when they're in the wilderness, we really begin to realize that there is really nothing all that different about Israel from Egypt. They're selfish, they're self-centered, they're ungodly in many of their thoughts and ways. They're worshiping false gods quite often. Remember when they get out into the desert, into the wilderness, one of the first things they do is they fashion a god unto themselves when Moses is gone for a few days because they are really Egyptian in their heart. 430 years. You know what? My ancestors came here from Ireland and Germany and things like that. I don't know a whole lot about Ireland and Germany. I would call myself an American. What about you? 430 years. That's longer than we've been a country. And the reality is that in their hearts, they're Egyptian. Everything about them is Egyptian. And so they're learning these lessons at the same time that Israel is learning these lessons. The only thing that's really distinctly different about Egypt and Israel is this. Israel is under a covenant of blood that they don't even fully understand. And so in that moment, they do what God says and they paint their doorposts. But remember this. If their doorposts aren't painted with the blood of the Lamb, if they're not covered by the blood of the Lamb, then the Israelites suffer the same fate as the Egyptians. Because the truth is this, that as God's judgment is coming on the land, everybody's guilty. Nobody is innocent by any standard of the law. In fact, the Apostle Paul said something like that to us 3,000 years after that point in time in which he said that the wages of sin is death and that there is none righteous, no, not even one. And so we have this understanding as Christians in one sense and this other sense of not understanding as people who live in the world around us. So on the one hand that we know it's true that the Bible says that the wages of sin is death and that all sin, but on the other hand we have this deep-seated kind of doubt in all of that because we're just like everybody else. We're Egyptians at heart. And we can't imagine what anything about us could be all that bad. So Egypt is faced with this whole thing. Now let's think about what's been happening to Egypt in the midst of all this. What's led up to this point? We don't just have a sudden vacuum of, you know, and all of a sudden now God is making judgment and pronouncement, but instead we have, this is their 10th time to be warned about what's going to happen to them. And the interesting thing is that this was foreseen even before one of those miracles was spoken. God gave Moses the warning that it was going to lead to this. And yet, Israel didn't want to hear it, and Egypt didn't want to hear it. And so each time judgment would come upon them, in the midst of it, they would go, oh, no, this is terrible, this is terrible, this is no good. We're sorry, and God would relent. And Moses would go outside and he'd go, and he even said to him after a couple of times, now look, God's not dumb. I'm going to walk out here and I'm going to pray for you, but I know your heart. I'm going to, the frogs are going to be gone, the gnats are going to be gone, and you're going to go and act just the same way. Oh, no, not this time. We've really learned our lesson this time. Have you ever said that to God before? Oh, God, I'll never do that again. And I can remember some times in my youth especially making all kinds of promises to God on my knees or in a painful situation and going, oh God, if you get me out of this, I will never do that again. Liar. Talking about me, I'm sure that you never did that. And so in the midst of all of this, you see, the truth is that there's not any different between Egypt and Israel. Now, one of the things that is most difficult for us to grab hold of that is because in the text it says this, it says that God's about, that it would increase God's honor. Now, in our culture, in 21st century America, the reality is that when we hear honor, that it would increase God's glory, we don't hear honor, we hear aggrandizement. We hear vainglory. We hear the sense of making things bigger than they are. You know what aggrandizement is? Like when you go fishing and they go, the fish was this big, right? And we know that the fish was really like this big, but when every time they tell the story, it gets a little bit bigger like this and a little bit bigger like this, and it's vainglory. And usually when we talk about someone getting the glory, what we really mean is we mean that kind of vain glory where we make everything grander than it is, grandiose. And a lot of times when we read this and we read about God's glory in the midst of people dying, and we see that and we go, man, I don't know if I like God. I don't know if I can trust God because, now let me get this straight, he gets glory when people die? And we start to interpret God through a 21st century filter, misunderstanding. Here's the deal, is that in the Bible, glory and honor are the same concept. In fact, one of the things that's been done recently in reaching out to people in Eastern countries, especially in Muslim countries, but all over the East, is that they've started translating in the book of John is full of the word doxa. In our English Bibles, it is nearly always translated glory. But the thing is the truth is that doxa is honor. And so they've gone back in an honor-based culture and translated the word doxa as honor, but in a glorifying culture, I don't know if you know of any glorifying cultures where people like to glorify people, but they translate it glory because that's what we want to hear. But the truth is that God's honor and his glory are tied up one in the same. When you understand the concept of honor and you understand the whole thing of the rule of law, it doesn't take long to make the conclusion that God is either dishonest or true. You see, if he's dishonest, then all of us who are quote-unquote his favorites because we've been saved, added to the covenant, etc. like that, then God doesn't pass judgment on us and it matters nothing and we can sin all we want and behave however we want and we can do whatever we want in the world and it doesn't matter. But that's not what the scripture teaches. It's often become our interpretation of what grace means, but you know, I'm captivated by the simple fact that in Hebrews chapter 10, there's all kinds of warning to those who would trample underfoot the Son of God by treating the blood of the covenant as a common thing and to continue to sin and behave in a way that brings pain to God, and it says that introduces him to suffering all over again. Huge contrast between those two things. And yet, this is what I know. I know that my sins are forgiven and that I do have grace and mercy from God. And how do I reconcile those things? And the answer is it's in the honor of God, that God stood at the doorpost where they were painted with blood and he stood in the gap and he did not deny the hit. He didn't say to the angel, you know what? Those are my favorite people. Don't let them come under judgment. Instead, God stood in the doorway and said, I will take the hit. I will suffer their loss. You know, it's interesting to me how sometimes people try to paint God in the Old Testament different than God in the New Testament. I don't understand that because the God of the New Testament that died, who sent his son to die on a cross, is the same God who took the hit at the door because of the blood of the Lamb. Same story, second verse, same as the first. You see, the God of mercy, of kindness, was the same God who said, all right, I'm going to let you off the hook and I'm going to take away the gnats. Oh, goody, like God's an idiot. Oh, then we'll just go back to doing whatever we want. God says, I knew you were going to do it. Don't do it again. The next time, please pray that the Lord would deliver me. He goes out and he prays the Lord. He says, I know, but you know what you're going to do? You're going to go right back like the dog that returns to the vomit. You're going right back. Oh, no, not this time. It's completely different this time. Oh, the plague is gone. Woohoo! Let's party. You see, Egypt by no means could be considered not guilty or unaware or like they hadn't received testimony. But, well, that's not fair. I mean, he finally gets their attention and now he takes the people of God out of their midst. He's been getting their attention for over a year. See, these events didn't unfold in a week. These events didn't unfold over a month. You just start adding up what's happening in the plagues and the time between them, and you're well over a year. God spent an entire year plus getting their attention, saying, listen, this is what God is like. He is patient and kind and long-suffering. He will wipe out the judgments against you and bring you hope and joy and peace and comfort. But they said, we don't want your peace and your joy and your comfort. We don't want your ways, O God. You see, while they said they didn't know him, they, at this point, they know him. And they're really down to two choices that day. They're down to the choice that Egypt makes, or they're down to the choice that Israel makes. You see, both of them got their education in the same time period. And at the end of that time period, the people of Israel say, I think this stuff is for real. And they got under the blood. They painted their doorways. They followed the instructions, not because they were good, not because they were righteous, not because they were better people, but they surrendered to the protection of God that day and said, I know that I'm not right. And Egypt said, I don't care what God says. I'm not going to obey. Does that really make God mean and awful and unloving and unkind, as I keep hearing that supposedly the God of the Old Testament is? Or is he a God of mercy and compassion and just doesn't ignore the cause of justice? You do still want justice in the land, don't you? Justice when someone robs and murders and steals and kills or wages war against people or rapes the innocent, abuses children. You still want justice in the land, don't you? I do. I don't want to live in a land without justice. I don't want to live in a place where God just plays favorites. Do you? Really? I know in the moment it seems kind of comforting that you just to get away with things, but in truth, do you really want to live in a world where there's no justice, where God doesn't care? And so in a world where God cares very much and his justice comes to everyone, so is the promise that mercy can come to all under the blood of the Lamb. That God will hasah, he will stand at the doorway and take the hit, so that you don't have to. Cover me with the blood of the Lamb. Cover me with the blood of the Lamb. I don't need to get away. I need to change. And Egypt, God is not merciless to Egypt. You know, one of the things it points out is that there are those who will go in a mixed company that left the land with them. There were some of the Egyptians who in that day recognized that who God was, and they went with them toward the promised land. They became no longer strangers, but just like the native, living under one law, trusting in one God, one hope. But some just wanted to stay in Egypt, wanted to stay in bondage, wanted to stay in the land of doing whatever I want, when I want, and refusing to bow the knee to God. You know what's intriguing about all of that? That when you study Egyptian law, do you know they have laws against, in I'm not talking about modern Egypt, I'm talking about ancient Egypt, laws against blasphemy and laws about being pious and things like that. You see, even Egypt, who didn't know the true God, knew in their hearts that there is right and there is wrong. And they decided that they would do whatever they wanted to do. The invitation to you and me, and the invitation is simply this, that we would come under the blood of the Lamb, but then that we would never make light of the blood that was shed for us. You see, that's the call to why to live in righteousness, to live in holiness, to experience tenderness and relationship with God, and to live in a way that honors God. Because when we do sin, It's not that justice is ignored, it's that God takes the hit. Why would I want to do that to the Lord I love? So the call is for you and I to live righteous and holy, but to also live with the understanding that He takes the hit. He loved me enough. He loved us all. He so loved the world that He sent His one and only Son, that whoever would believe in Him would not perish. Same God, yesterday, today, and forever, always the same. Extends the same invitation to you and I that He extended to Egypt. Come out of bondage and enter into His love, into relationship with Him, into covenant with Him. Maybe it's not that tough of a passage after all. Let's stand again.